Thank you for letting me come back. It's good to be with you. It's always good to be in shirts. I'm honored to have a part in this effort, and I have for many years benefited from the not just being present for the lessons, but from the books produced, and they are a treasured part of my study library. Now, Lou Ann, my wife, laughed when I told her what my topic was. Until she saw hers. I confess I'm a little bit puzzled in that I know the sisters who are presenting the counterpart lessons to these lessons on Solomon. I know Sister Corey Wilson. I know Sister Jennifer O'Bannon. Of course, I know my wife. I looked at the lectureship schedule and realized that the brother presenting the lesson on Solomon as a young man was Keith Mosier, who is, well, he's not as young as Sister Wilson. And Billy Bland was presenting the lesson on Solomon in his middle of his life, and he's not as young as Jennifer. And so that sort of makes me, how old do you think I am, Stan? I've heard that there are three stages to a preacher's life, and I'm beginning to understand it a little bit more. There's the, boy, you're going to be a good preacher someday stage. And then there's the, boy, you should have heard him in his prime stage. And then there's the, he's still alive stage. And I'm a little bit concerned about where I may be. The overall story of Solomon is actually a cautionary tale. Not a tale in the sense of something made up, but it's a cautionary record from which we ought to learn a great deal and a great many very vital lessons. My challenge this morning, in one sense, is a difficult one in that I want to see Solomon at the end of his life clearly penitent, clearly faithful, clearly forgiven when he dies. There's one problem. I'm not sure I can. Is Ecclesiastes a record of Solomon ultimately repenting of his evil ways? I certainly hope so. I want to see him in glory. The last verses, this is the end of the matter. All hath been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. The King James Version supplies the word duty, but really the expression there denotes this is the sum of what it is to be a man. For God shall bring every work into judgment and every secret thing, whether good or evil. Those could be read as an admission of Solomon having learned that there's no satisfaction, no lasting satisfaction to be found in life under the sun. And yet, if it is that admission, it's the only biblical evidence that he repented. There's no express biblical statement that he turned from sin. There's no other statement that indicates in a positive, obvious way that he acknowledged the sinfulness of his polygamy, of his materialism, of his ego at times. There are, at least preserved for us, no penitential psalms like David's. There's no record of a moment of repentance before God like Manasseh's in 2 Chronicles 33. I want to see Solomon in glory. But frankly, I don't know if I will. I'm confident that Brother Mosier and Brother Bland covered Solomon's earlier life in far greater detail than I can, but I didn't get to hear those studies. And so I want to touch just a few details of his background to sort of set the stage for our study of Solomon in the closing years of his life. And by way of a little background, let's just point out that he appears to be the fourth son of King David to be born after David became king in Jerusalem. Apparently, he was the first legitimate child that David had with Bathsheba. Of course, their first child was conceived in an illegitimate way and died at birth. She had been, of course, the widow of David's faithful servant, Uriah, according to 2 Samuel 5. You can find some writers and some commentators that suppose that since she was married to Uriah, who was a Hittite, though he was a loyal servant of David, they suppose that means that she was a heathen woman and that she was a corruptive influence of sorts. And yet, if we go over and look at 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 3, and compare that with chapter 23, verse 34, we discover she was evidently Ahithophel's granddaughter. And Ahithophel, of course, was one of David's trusted counselors. That means that she was probably someone familiar to David, someone familiar with the court, familiar with the palace. The fact that she'd married this Hittite who was a servant of David should not be held against her in terms of her faithfulness religiously being anything less than a faithful Hebrew. Solomon, her son, is selected to succeed David, the great king, because he made an oath to Solomon's mother. He promised her, 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 13, 17, and 30, he had promised her that Solomon would sit upon his throne after he passed. Now let's think about Solomon's childhood for just a moment. As a small child, he was there, just a child, when his half-brother Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar. He was there when Amnon was murdered at another half-brother's command, Absalom. He was there when Absalom rebelled against their father and tried to murder David. He surely was an eyewitness to the grief and the turmoil that those events caused. Did he know that those events traced back directly to his father's relationship with his mother? I don't know. But certainly, he must have seen the impact of them. As he becomes a young man, assumes the throne, Solomon displays a great humility in asking God for wisdom, for understanding. He shows a very spiritual mind in focusing on getting the temple built. By the practical use of the wisdom God gave him, he becomes a fabulously wealthy man. He's very possibly the first billionaire in history, at least by modern standards. And that enabled him to amass not just a huge fortune for himself, but it enabled his nation to prosper. And it enabled him to indulge in massive construction projects as well. Not just the temple, but an extravagant ornate palace. And not just a palace, but cities and fortifications and other houses and things of that sort to suit himself. The shameful excess, however, of Solomon's later years traces back to these early years. Because it was during this time that Solomon began to marry. And not just once, not just two or three times, not just a few times like his father, but time after time after time after time after time. Most of these surely were political alliances and strategic relationships, and yet 700 wives. I always giggle when I think about Solomon because of something Don Walker comments on that. It's not the 700 wives that drag you down, it's the 700 mothers-in-law. And I think somebody mentioned that the other day as well. By taking hundreds of wives, not just wives though, but pagan brides, heathen women, into his harem, by keeping a harem. Stop right here. As Brother Wallace used to say, put down a tent peg. I won't make the kind of circuit he would. But just hold this thought for a second. Even though he was king, how many wives was Solomon actually legitimately entitled to have? One wife. God's plan from the get-go and Jesus alludes to this, Jesus references this in Matthew 19, is one man married to one woman for life. That's the design. That's the ideal. That's the pattern. And yet Solomon discarded that pattern. For all of his wisdom, he was foolish in his own example, because his example opened his kingdom to the excesses of idolatry and every sort of excess. What should have been his prime years, those years of middle-aged manhood, when he was energetic and vigorous and strong, when he was endowed with this massive, great wisdom that God had given him, what should have been his prime years seemed to be characterized by Solomon doing less in spiritual terms with his wisdom and more in practical terms, just concentrating on wealth and power than on anything else. It's telling. You look at 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 7. In that interview with God, in that prayer asking for wisdom, how does Solomon describe himself? I'm a little child. I don't know how to lead this people. The youth, the Hebrew there describes a youth, a lad, maybe a youngster of about 20. And that's why it's such a disappointment, such a shock to see his last years marked by estrangement, alienation from God. And that leaves us to wonder, when we turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, are we actually reading an indirect record of his ultimate repentance? Or are we just reading the inspired chronicle of what turns out ultimately to be an unhappy life? Because any life lived outside the guidance of God ultimately is unhappy. Now, 1 Kings chapter 11 is the record of Solomon's later years. Verse 4 declares that when Solomon was old, and I want to come back to that word in just a moment, but when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his hearts after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He ruled for 4 decades. If you study secular history, if you go and read Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews and so forth, Josephus says he became king at age 14, but Josephus also says he reigned 80 years, and that contradicts what the scripture says. He reigned 40 years. When he reaches his old age, Solomon was old. He must have been in his 50s. And we kind of laugh. And some of the scholars say, well, life expectancy wasn't that long in those days. But you know, the psalmist says 70 or 80, or if by reason of strength, 40 years. 70 or 80 years and I fly away. What to us is a normal, healthy lifespan wasn't out of the question in those days either. David, his father, reigned 40 years, but he died at age 70. And yet here, Solomon is described as an old man, and he's approaching 60. That tells you a little bit about what a life of dissipation will do to you. How many of us, now, those of you students who are still under 40, you can just discount this momentarily. But for the rest of us, how many of us would look at a man in his 50s or even his 60s and say, oh, he's an old man? But Solomon was. The first faint hint of spiritual trouble for Solomon seems to be in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 1. He marries a wife. Oh, this should be a joyous occasion. And I'm sure it was celebrated. But he's a little bit like Samson. Had David still been alive at that point, surely David would have said, isn't there a nice Jewish girl good enough for you? because she was an Egyptian princess. And that marriage seems to have set the course for much of his life. We don't find Egyptian idolatry specifically mentioned later on in the sins that come to characterize his life. But we also don't find that first wife, or any other for that matter, ever became a proselyte Jew. Josephus tells us that Solomon married many Jewish or Hebrew princesses, high-ranking Hebrew women, but he also had a whole passel of foreigners as well. And they're the ones that get the attention. At this point in his life, we read in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 3, that the great king still loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father. When God appeared to him at Gibeon, he was sensible. God said, "You can have anything you want. Let me have wisdom. Let me have an understanding heart." God was pleased by his request in verses 6, 7, 8, 9 there in 1 Kings chapter 3. What Solomon asked of God could have made him effectively the Christ of the Old Testament had he only used God's blessings properly. And yet, there's an implicit warning that accompanies God's promises, not just of wisdom and understanding, but also wealth and honor and long life. You go to 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 14, he says, "If you continue to serve me faithfully." I don't know anyone here who would look at Solomon, compare him to David, compare him to some of the other kings, and say that Solomon lived a long life. He reigned for 40 years. But he was not an old man when he died. Brethren, I would suggest that tells us something about his level of faithfulness, his level of commitment to God in his later years. The fame of his wisdom spread throughout the ancient world in his early years. He acquires all of this huge, immense wealth. And although he continues to go through the motions of going to the temple, offering the sacrifices, 1 Kings chapter 9 and verse 25, other things begin to creep in during these middle years, going into his later years, increasing the distance between the king and his God. Even though God appeared to him a second time at Gibeon, in 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 2 through 9, we find that the reality is Solomon begins to fulfill Samuel's prophecies about the abuses that an earthly king would inflict on Israel. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. The people come to Samuel, "Give us a king so we can be just as filthy, nasty, stinking, dirty, rotten, ungodly, unholy, disgusting as the heathen around us." And it made Samuel mad. God says, "Don't take it personally, Samuel. It's not you, but me they've rejected. They had a king all along." But then, by inspiration, Samuel begins to tell them, "All right, you want an earthly king? You're going to get one, but you'll be sorry you did, because here's what he's going to be like. He's going to conscript your sons for forced labor. He's going to draft your daughters into his harem. He's going to appropriate your men to be charioteers and horsemen. And he's going to enrich himself to underwrite his building projects at your expense." And Solomon ultimately did all of those things. His moral decline seems to have really begun in earnest once the temple was completed and dedicated. We look at the beautiful, the magnificent prayer that he offers at the dedication of the temple. We see the extraordinary amount of offerings and the huge volume of wealth that they represented. But, brethren, that seems almost to be the high point of his spiritual life. It appears that it just was a gradual decline downhill, maybe bending farther down the farther he went. From that point on, no doubt Solomon would have excused his extravagances, the palaces, the shields, the ornate decorations, the throne with the carved heads of lions on it, and the golden drinking vessels and so forth. I don't doubt that he would excuse that and say, well, that's due, that's proper, that's right, as a reflection of the greatness of our God embodied by me. Makes me wonder, though, did he not realize that the sculpting of the lions on his throne at least was a borderline violation of Exodus 20 and verse 4 against the graven images? That's how the Pharisees later understood it. You know, in the intertestamental period, the carving of anything other than abstract geometric shapes was forbidden among the Pharisees. In the first century, you didn't find lifelike carvings in Israel. It wasn't done. Despite his great wisdom, what we see here is that Solomon's heart is increasingly divided as time goes by. Surely Solomon understood the principle of Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24, that no man can serve two masters. And yet, in effect, that's what he was trying to do. When he started to push the boundaries of God's laws with his marriages, with his ego, with his materialism, it was just a short step on into idolatry. We get into his later years there in 1 Kings chapter 11, and we see the decline of his relationship with God. At that point, he's ruled for maybe 20 or so years. His downfall is rooted in his own heart, not in the pressures, the nagging, or the wheedling of his wives. Yes, they turned away his heart. Yes, they bear some shame or some credit, however you want to account for it there. But even though it says they turned away his heart, it was he who had desired them, accepted them, taken them as wives in the first place, despite knowing God's law. It was he who inflicted upon himself his fall into sin. Temptation is always an illegitimate appeal to a legitimate God-given desire. And Solomon had dived headfirst into these temptations. He came in turn to actually misuse and abuse his wives, treating them effectively as ornaments that would be just tokens of his wealth and his power and his might. I can afford to have all of this. There's no doubt in my mind that he thought that he was the strong and dominant party in these relationships with his wives and his concubines, but it's very clear that they had far more influence on him than he realized, and seemingly much more influence on him than he had on them. There's not one word in the Bible that suggests that he ever turned any of them away from paganism. Ultimately, the faithfulness, the loyalty that he owed God ended up being given to them and to their idols in his later years. In describing Solomon's dedication to his women, in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 2, we find the very same word that Moses used back in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 4, and again in chapter 10 and verse 20, and again in chapter 30 and verse 20, where it describes the Hebrews' responsibility to hold fast to God. Solomon's heart clave unto his wives. That word is the same one that Moses uses to describe how Israel is supposed to cleave to God, to be welded to him. No man can serve two masters. It led him into idolatry. That led to God's anger being directed at him. And if he is the writer of Proverbs chapter 31, then his own words condemn his practices. 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 4, we find him described as old. It's the same word that you find in Genesis 24:36. Sarah was old. She was past the age of childbearing. We know how old Sarah was. Bless her heart. Can you imagine being a first-time mama in your 90s? Solomon is described as old, and he's 30-something years, almost 40 years younger than she was. Boy, that's what a life of dissipation does to you. his idolatrous wives turned his heart away from God. And the root of that word means to stretch out, to thin out. They wore him down. They eroded his faithfulness, his resolve. His heart was not perfect. And that figure, that expression, not perfect, comes from a root for the word shalom that means peace. He didn't have any peace with God because sin was in the way. As long as we have sin in our lives that is not corrected, we will not have peace with God, with one another, or within. His heart was not safe. His heart was not whole because he had divided it and had no peace. David had responded to God's anger with humility by begging forgiveness, with penitence and confession of his sins. Look at Psalm 32. Look at Psalm 51. We see the condition of David's heart. But even though he composed 3,000 Proverbs and 1,005 songs, we have nothing from Solomon that even faintly resembles David's penitence. It's interesting. It says he went after the gods of his wives, the false gods of his wives. And that's a figure of speech that's very similar to Paul's description of the triumphant procession that we get to be in behind Christ in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 14. It's the position of coming behind the conqueror. The Hebrew writer here, the inspired penman, is telling us that Solomon allowed himself to be conquered by sin and idolatry. He built high places for his wives' wicked worship. And you go to 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 7 where they're mentioned, and that specific instance seems to have been on the Mount of Olives, directly across from the temple where Jesus would spend much time with his disciples. What Solomon built there was an altar. It was a table-like platform, a place for idolatrous rituals and sacrifices. And it was apparently not the only one that he built, according to verse 8. Solomon, as ruler, as leader, as king, Solomon was directly responsible for filling the land with sites for the worship of idols. This particular one was in plain sight of the temple. Can you imagine what must have gone through the high priest's mind day in and day out as the abomination of idolatry took place right there in plain sight? Whether Solomon actually participated personally in his wives' idol worship, or whether he simply enabled them to do it, is immaterial. Makes no difference. Either way, he was fully guilty of permitting and facilitating the defiling practices that were expressly prohibited in the very first of the Ten Commandments. It's been mentioned that the worship of Chemosh and Molech and other Canaanite deities entailed live child sacrifice by fire. Even if he did not permit that himself during his own lifetime. And it may be that that did not occur at that point. There's no mention of it in connection with Hebrew idolatry until we get to King Ahaz in 2 Kings chapter 16. Even if he didn't actually permit that in his own lifetime, the practice was still known. And the precedent was still set during the reign of Solomon. And so the Lord's anger was kindled against him. God had personally instructed him in 1 Kings chapter 9 and verse 6, avoid these sins. And so he was utterly without excuse where God was concerned. He knew better Not even the high priest had the privilege of speaking directly with God like he did on two occasions. And yet, what did he do with the great wisdom God gave him? Mainly, he applied it to satisfying, to fulfilling his own lusts. Solomon's trail for the nation of Israel led inexorably to conquest and captivity in Assyria and Babylon. 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 4 and 9. The warning, the statement given in 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 11, 12, and 13. The Lord said unto Solomon, "For as much as this is done of thee, thou hast not kept my commandment and my statutes, which I have commanded thee. Because of this, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and give it to thy servant, notwithstanding in thy days I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to thy son for David my servant's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, which I've chosen." Those words, probably spoken through a prophet, maybe through Ahijah or through Iddo or one of the men of that era, parallel the revelation that God had given at Gibeon. In that warning, in that declaration, God is pronouncing judgment on Solomon. He's telling him somebody lesser, somebody who's not as regal, not as great, not as wonderfully royal as you, is going to be the beneficiary of most of your labor. You've degraded yourself in your sin, and so the kingdom will suffer because of you. His son, Rehoboam, would be his successor, but Rehoboam was not up to the task. Jeroboam, who would tear away 10 of the 12 tribes, Jeroboam was nowhere near his equal. But in a sense, he followed very much in Solomon's footsteps by introducing further idolatry into the nation of Israel. How much time does that mean I have? 3 minutes. All right. Solomon's practices denied the foundational truth that there is one God, only one God, no other God beside him, that was stated in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 4. He was just as guilty of robbing God in his day as the leaders of Israel were, Judah that is, in Malachi's day, in Malachi chapter 3 verses 8 and 10, 8, 9 and 10. By sanctioning the worship of idolatry, he was defying the Almighty. He was misusing the wisdom that God had given him against the very one who had given it. Jedidiah, as he's called, the beloved of the Lord, 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 25, fell in a time of peace, prosperity, experience, maturity. He sinned in the rank egotism of his unrestrained, unlimited lust. He couldn't plead while I was young and inexperienced, because he wasn't. He let his lust rule his intellect instead of his knowledge of God's wisdom governing his desire. When God raised up enemies for Solomon, his purpose was to get the king's attention, to get him to examine himself and reconsider his course. He used external foes and internal foes. There should have been no doubt in Solomon's mind about the reality and the seriousness of God. He was truly without excuse for his conduct. Now let's think just for a moment about the consequences of sin and some lessons that we can apply. The consequences are that all sins have consequences. There's no escape from them. Solomon's no exception to this rule. When you get the manuscript, you'll find that there's a list of 7 or 8 things there, consequences of his sin. But then we see as practical lessons, no one is too high, too holy, too safe to be immune to temptation. And no one is exempt from heaven's justice. False religions, the idolatry of Solomon and his people, are inevitably exposed by their own exceptions to the rules. Hypocrisy is the invariable landmark, hallmark of human religion, unlike the perfect consistency of the gospel. Malachi 3:6 and Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 8. Solomon squandered his abilities and his opportunities with the irresponsibility of sin. God never changed. God never moved. But Solomon did to his own hurt. He withdrew from close fellowship with the Father, from spiritual safety and security, not the other way around. Solomon illustrates for us the danger of distraction in focusing on what he wanted instead of what God wanted. I believe Solomon lost everything. Jesus cautions in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15 that our worth is not measured by what we possess, but by our richness toward God. In Matthew 6, verses 19, 20, and 21, we read words that Solomon, in his great wisdom, should have appreciated. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon the earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through and steal, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Is Ecclesiastes a record that Solomon ultimately repented of his evil ways? I hope so. But he's conspicuously absent from faith's hall of fame in Hebrews chapter 11. And he's rarely used as an example in the New Testament. He had every advantage a man could want. But if he repented, we'll not know it until eternity. Thank you for the opportunity and for your kind attention.